The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Secrets.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you are into science and Bible believers by nature of the fact that they accept these miracles and fairy tales, are into fantasy. Actually, my friend, you would be surprised. I know a lot of atheists, not just the ones that I bring on the show to debate. I'm actually friends with a plethora of atheists, but one of my atheist friends did come on the show a number of years ago. And before our debate, I said something to him, and I don't think I had ever asked an atheist this question before. I said to him, I've noticed that atheists are not only into science, but science fiction. They love science fiction. They love comic books. Of course, this guy was into comic books. He was into Star Trek. In fact, when I debated him over at Foothills Church a few months later, just to kind of break the ice and keep it a cordial debate, the moderator asked each of us Star Trek geeks what our favorite episode of Star Trek was first. We got along great. But anyway, I asked him this question. I said, I noticed that for all their talk about a natural universe and they don't believe in the supernatural, atheists just gravitate towards science fiction and to a lesser degree, fantasy. And I said to him, is it possible that they are trying to fill a void? That they're assuming this stuff isn't real, so they get into the science fiction because there's something in the human psyche that wants the fantastic and the supernatural. His response, and it's very much to his credit that he was so honest, he said, that's very insightful of you. Of course, there's that famous television sitcom Big Bang Theory, where they do a lot of comedy and they exaggerate it. But these guys are all atheists and into science, but they never miss Comic-Con, and they're all into Star Trek, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. Anyway, all to say that today we are going to be reviewing a couple of science fiction movies, several science fiction movies, and a fantasy movie. And of course, we don't do that on the Bob Siegel Show without first bringing in film critic Mark Boobian. Nick, our board op, will probably jump in and say a few things too. Nick and Mark, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's great to be here again.
It's good having you.
And you know, you mentioned filling a void, and what's interesting about science fiction to me in particular is, what are they filling that void with? It's not just science fiction, or it's not just looking at the future, but thematically, a lot of times what these movies are saying or connecting with is something about not just humanity, but about God, and in particular, Jesus and Christianity as well. That's one of the things.
Or at least the struggle between good and evil.
Well, at the very least, yeah. At the very limit.
And
right.
Many times atheists will claim to be moral relatives. Some of them will claim that they're not moral relativists. But actually, if God didn't exist, you'd almost have to take that position. But without going there, even a moral relativist, they'll go see a movie like Lord of the Rings and they'll love it. And they'll say, well, how can you not believe in good and evil and love this movie? They say, well, it's a fantasy. And I say, yes, it's a fantasy. But if you didn't really believe in good versus evil, there'd be nothing about the conflict that would draw you in.
Right, exactly. I think our beliefs deep down really kind of they deny what we say in a sense, because deep down inside, I think we all are not moral relativists, because you know, eventually moral relativism breaks down no matter how you look at it.
Yep, you could be in a classroom and someone says there's no such thing as God and therefore no such thing as values, it's all relative. And then you walk outside your classroom, you discover somebody swiped your bicycle, the first thing you do is cry out in moral indignation.
Right, the end of moral relativism.
In fact,
right there.
One of the greatest arguments people have against Christianity that I hear all the time is they talk about religious hypocrisy. So I always say to them, let me ask you something, are you morally outraged by religious hypocrisy? They say yes. I said, well, I thought you said there's no such thing as morals. So in their own Freudian slips, they reveal how they really believe things.
Right, right. Well, one thing that's interesting, I was watching a movie with a friend the other day, The Watchmen. And I've never seen the movie. We didn't actually finish it. But there's a character in the movie named Rorschach, and very off-putting character, very dark and negative character. And all of the qualities of this character, everything he's saying is the stereotypical Republican kind of Christian sort of very strong moral stance, but also very condemning and very judgmental and all of those negative things you associate with a conservative, an arch-conservative, not just a conservative, but an arch-conservative.
Or at least things the media associates with it
exactly.
And portrays them as.
And the things that you don't like about them and all of these things. But the irony of this character is he's one of the most talked about and most identified with, and dare I say, most loved character from The Watchmen. So why is it that people that they latch on to this guy so well and so much? Because in the mainstream, a lot of people are very liberal-minded, and on the internet in particular, you'll see many discussions that I'm involved in are very liberal in their stance. And for somebody to identify with this highly conservative and almost fascist character is shocking. And the friend I was watching it with actually said that he thinks that it's because the guy, even though he's so fascist in his stance, at least he has a stance. At least he stands for something. He is actually fighting right and wrong in the movie. That's his motivation. He is the sort of moral center of the film, and he is the catalyst for seeking out what is just and what is right. And people, I think, really identify with that aspect of him. And so because he's the only one that can really take a stand, because he's the one that has morals, that even though they're very strict, people identify with him because of he's the only one that's really able to say there is good and evil, and I'm going to fight for good or right or what is just. And no other character really in The Watchmen can actually do that.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite plays is A Man for All Seasons. An Academy Award-winning movie was made out of it, too, written by a guy named Robert Bolt. And his preface before the play, he mentions that he's an agnostic, but he picks this man who's Sir Thomas More, one of the helpers and employees of Henry VIII, the infamous Henry VIII,
right,
during the time of his great divorce and the Church of England starting. And, you know, it's fiction based on fact. He's writing a play, and he says, I chose this man not because I share his beliefs, but because I admire somebody who knew boundaries, knew right from wrong, and knew where he would not cross, and knew how far he would compromise and where his conscience would kick in. So it is interesting.
Yeah.
The arts are quite a reflection of that.
Right, and they challenge us, too. That's one of the things I really like about the arts, and one of the reasons that I'm actually even here to talk about these movies is because I love being challenged. I love having somebody ask a question and not necessarily answer it, but to show me something that's going to challenge me mentally, morally even, and see how I respond. And I really enjoy that.
Yeah, that reminds me, you know, it's been 4 years. I realize it's been 4 years since the last Star Trek movie.
Was it really
in this
4 years
new series?
Ago?
Yeah, it came out in May of 2009. That means, Mark, it's been 4 years since that time we were reviewing Star Trek and one of our listeners called in and literally read us the riot act over the show.
Right.
That here a program about Christianity would waste a whole program talking about Star Trek. And we tried to convey to him that to us the arts are important and we're not the kind of Star Trek geeks that put on uniforms. But it's not just Star Trek. Before I became a Christian, the year I became a Christian, I was watching the old Star Trek reruns, and they were talking a lot about good and evil, particularly in the original Star Trek.
Right.
They called it the savage side of man. It's what the Bible would have called the sinful side of man. But it wasn't just that. I was also into the plays of Arthur Miller, and I was noticing he was saying the same things about mankind. That was instrumental in my search. That year, I had never read so much novels in 1 year in my life, and between the movies I watched, the TV shows I watched, the things I wrote, and the things I read, I realized now that in my own way I was searching for God. But I, not having a religious background, I was searching as an artist. And
right.
That's why, to both of us, we feel a real passion about these arts.
Absolutely, because this goes beyond politics and culture and everything. It really just touches us, the arts. And I think of movies, I don't know if I've probably mentioned this before, and I'll mention it again, that to me, movies are our generation's art form. It's the modern art. It's not, music's been around forever. Classical music is still music.
Live theater's been around since the time of the ancient Greeks.
But movies are just, they're the last 100 years or so, and that's basically our generation. And so we really relate to movies because that's what we've grown up with and what we've connected with. And I think it's just an absolutely wonderful and awesome thing. And even, you know, people say, oh, this is a popcorn movie during the summer, or this is just one of those blockbusters. These are the movies that you just go to see to have fun and throw away your brain and just enjoy. But even these movies, these are going to have a lot to say most of the time. Not every time, of course, but a lot of times there is a theme, there is a message, there's something in these movies.
Well, I would say a movie should either entertain or have a message. Often it does both.
Right.
And they're usually brilliant when they do both. But I agree with you that often even just a comedy, and I know that I like television sitcoms more than you do. I think we probably agree that 99% of the television sitcoms are garbage, but there's a few that I like. I don't think you like any of them.
No, I'm not a big fan.
Yeah, but when I do like a sitcom, it's because it's not just funny, it's brilliant, and that in a comedic way, they're saying something about human nature, and we find it recognizable, and I believe that's why we laugh.
Right, absolutely.
So if a movie can both entertain and have a message, all the better.
Yeah, and you know, I come on and I talk about these movies that have some kind of something to say, or even something below the surface, where we see a reflection of ourselves, or even, like I said earlier, a reflection of Christ, a reflection of God in these films. And I think that's amazing. Even films that are done by people that are avowed atheists, I often see something about God in those movies, whether they put it there deliberately or not.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, we just spun a fantastic rationalization for this all movie program.
Right.
So we probably better finally get into it here.
Okay, well, you know what? Before we start talking about the movies, I wanted to make a little observation about this year. Typically, what has been happening in the last maybe 5 years is that summer has been sort of getting closer and closer to winter in terms of movies, because they're pushing the blockbusters back further and further.
Didn't Lucas begin that by he would put Star Wars out in May because he wanted kids to still be in school to talk about it. He figured if it came out in the summer, he's not going to get all that grassroots publicity.
See, and that's great, because that's what you should be doing. You should see a movie and talk about it. That's wonderful. And I remember being a kid when Star Wars came out, and a teacher actually telling us about the movie and how great it was and how somebody went and saw it so many times. So that's a brilliant move.
Releasing
on his part.
It in May is when Lucas had his head set square on his shoulders. Creating Jar Jar Binks was a different day, where his head was not as squarely set.
Right. I don't think so. But now, though, I think people have... What happened was that Iron Man, basically the first Iron Man, really started this pushing the movies earlier in the year, because Iron Man was basically a huge risk on the part of the studio. It was a comic book movie when comic book movies were only Batman or Superman. It was a big risk. And there's this actor who'd been a drug addict for so many years. Nobody even wanted him to be in a movie because he was such a financial risk. And then the director, who they had chosen, actually went to bat for him, Robert Downey Jr., and brought him into the movie. And obviously he was brilliant in the film, and it made millions of dollars. And then suddenly people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, there's this untapped period of time before the summer. And now it's before Iron Man, there was Oblivion this year. And before Oblivion, there was the Wizard of Oz movie, and so on. They're really pushing it back earlier.
Yeah,
and
usually the two big release times are Christmas, so that it's fresh in the Academy's mind for the Academy Awards. And that's usually the artsier stuff.
That's right.
And then summer, when it's the fun popcorn ones.
Right.
But as you've said, summer's getting pushed all the way back into winter now.
Yeah, and I think that's great, because it gives us more of an opportunity to see good movies. There's more movies.
Instead of them saying, this is the time of the year we make the bad movies, they'll try to make their good movies all year long.
That's right. Now, the interesting thing to me is it used to be 4th of July was the big tentpole of the year. And this year, the funny thing about 4th of July is it's a very high-risk movie. That they're going to release, and all of the really obvious movies that are going to attract an audience are being jammed into May and June. So let me throw a few of the movies out to you. We've already had, like I said, Star Trek, Iron Man. Next week, I'm not sure if that's Memorial Day weekend or not, but Fast and the Furious 6. Before Star Trek, the theater I saw Star Trek at was running a preview of Fast and the Furious. There were more people there for Fast and the Furious than there were for the four showings of Star Trek that night. Because it was a preview night.
I don't think our administration wants to remind anyone of Fast and Furious. They got three other scandals to deal with this week.
Right, maybe so, but this is the sixth movie. But the it's an insanely successful series of movies, and it being released, you know, in next week, that's a significant thing. They're going to make a ton of money. And it's going to be I'm sure it's just going to be incredibly
popular. These days, they assume that they don't make a lot of money opening night or the first weekend that it's a flop? Movies don't get time to grow legs anymore or build traction.
Right. There are a few exceptions to that, fortunately. But yeah, in general, that's the way things are viewed. And I don't think they have any problem with Fast and the Furious. Hangover 3, which they may have problems with. That's another big movie. Epic.
I did not. I only saw Hangover 1. I did not like it at all.
No, I'm not.
I didn't think
it
was funny. I didn't think it was clever. It was predictable. I did not like it.
I liked it a little bit, but not a ton. I mean, I just was kind of like, okay, whatever. Then I actually saw on HBO Hangover 2, and it's awful.
Well, usually when a movie has a number after it, it is awful.
Yeah, and then, you know, okay, so I can see them getting a hangover a second time and forgetting everything.
And then they try to justify, but go, oh, it was originally meant to be a trilogy. And then when they come out with movie four, they don't know what to use it as an excuse anymore. Trilogy sounds good. Movie four, they're without excuse.
Right, and after that, After Earth is another movie. Will Smith is the most consistent money-making actor in the last 10 years.
Well, I have to say that almost everything he's been in, I have liked.
Well,
he picks good projects, and he's a good actor. It's not just that he's a good actor. Nicolas Cage is a good actor, too, but half the stuff he picks,
I
hate.
It's terrible, yeah.
Yeah, same with Michael Caine. He's a good actor, but he'll be in anything. He'll be in a movie about growing a bean field. If it's Michael Caine, he'll be in it. But some actors pick good movies. I'd say Kevin Costner's another one. Leonardo DiCaprio is another one that picks very unique scripts. Sometimes they don't even do well at the box office because they took such a risk with them.
Yeah, but I agree.
Will Smith does it. I mean, it's always successful with him. They almost always do well at the box
office. Yes, they do. They don't almost all. They always do well. That's the amazing thing about Will Smith. So he's got a movie with his son in it. The difference is this movie is going to actually be more about the son in the film than about Will Smith.
And his son is really played by his real son?
Yes.
His
real son.
That's probably why he was happy to step aside and let his son do more.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of viewed as, here you go, son. Here's your chance to make it big.
And then Superman's coming out this summer, too.
That's right.
Man of Steel.
And this looks like a good Superman movie. Speaking of Kevin Costner,
I was going to say, because you never liked Batman until the new Batman series began.
Right.
Isn't this the same director or at least the same producer doing jumpstarting Superman?
It's the same producer.
Same producer.
Yeah, but it is Zack Snyder, the guy that did Watchmen that I mentioned earlier. He is the person that's doing Superman, and he has a very interesting visual style about him. He did 300 as well, which got him sort of noticed or got him on the radar because it was so visually interesting and appealing. And Watchmen is the same sort of thing. Just you could hate the movie, but I'd really have a hard time saying anything bad about how the movie looks or sounds. It's a brilliantly filmed movie. So
he didn't grow up as a
big
comic book lover like our friend Tim.
I believe he did.
I grew up liking comic books too. I haven't been into them as an adult, but it's interesting because you've never liked the superhero movies, and yet I believe it started with Iron Man and the newer Batman series that started with Batman Begins.
Right.
And if you now may even like Superman, we may see a complete metamorphosis of Mark Boopian here.
Right. Much as I've hated Batman, I've hated Superman more.
Well, I got to tell you, as a current comic book reader, I'm the only one in this building right now who's actually following comic books currently. And I even have to agree that I think over the last, I think some people would say over the last 12 years, I would probably say over the last 8 or 9 years, we've really seen comic book movies really step up. Because, I mean, before that, they've been spotty. There have been a few good ones here and there. I really liked the first Superman movie.
I did too.
The Tim Burton, the original Tim Burton Batman is the first
the
movie.
First, the one with Jack Nicholson I liked.
Right, yeah. I liked that. And that was the first movie I ever saw in theaters too. So.
Oh, really? Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, it was. At 4 years old. So
wow. First movie I ever saw in theaters was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I went with my sister.
At 4 years old.
Yeah. It made me hate clowns. I'll tell you that. But
yeah, no kidding. If your first experience with a clown is Jack Nicholson,
goodness. No kidding.
I think if your first experience with a clown is a clown, you're going to hate clowns.
I still get nervous with mimes.
Clowns are always kind of weird anyway.
I still get nervous with mimes, like that scene in the movie where they're shooting up City Hall. Oh, man. Every time I see a mime, that pops into my head.
See, now, with me, mimes just bug me. Having been in drama, I was around a lot of mimes. And mimes just, it's just...
Talk, you idiot!
For people that don't talk, right. They project an awful lot of arrogance about what they're doing. And I really don't care if they can imagine a wall. I mean, it just does nothing for me.
Yeah, but basically, my point is that I think we're kind of in the middle of the golden period of superhero comic book movies. I really think we are.
Yeah, yeah. And with the revolution in special effects, although you got to admit, with
I
the
think
original...
people are taking him more seriously, too. I think more people are open to taking him seriously.
Right.
And with the Superman that we had in the late 70s, the Christopher Reeve, we're sitting there going, how in the world did they do that? I have to admit, now I go, oh, well, they did it all on computer. That's how they did it. And, I mean, I'm still respectful of the new techniques that they're using, but... It really left a lot more to your imagination before, but it is true that with technology, we can just do anything now in movies, and so maybe this is a good or an easier time to do the superheroes.
Absolutely. You can do any of them.
I think what you pointed out, though, that people are taking these movies seriously, because comic books were just for kids, you know, nobody takes that seriously.
Yeah.
Science fiction was the same way. It's for kids.
True.
It's got this, and you know, science fiction really took off in the 80s and 90s. Star Wars started it, and then I actually think Terminator was the movie that really launched science fiction as the blockbuster, because it showed that it could be a very serious, dark genre for movies.
It was kind of like a 1-2-3-4-5 punch. I mean, you had Star Wars, then you had Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Right.
Then you had
Empire they came
Strikes
out the same
Back.
Year.
Yeah, they did. Then you had Empire, Jedi, you had E.T. in there. You
and
had
the Indiana
Terminator.
Jones series was thrown in between.
Right.
Superman and came out around
so,
that time.
I mean, boom, 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 boom. Yeah. I mean, all these great, really respectable, really seriously taken sci-fi movies just came. And I think it's the same thing with comic book movies right now, too.
And my main axe to grind, though, is that usually the actors in those movies don't get nominated. There was an exception when
that's
the first Lord of the Rings came out. They nominated the guy that played Gandalf. But it's, to me, if somebody's in a fantasy, the acting has to be all the better, because the acting...
It's not all
care
there.
How good the, I don't care how good the special effects are. If we don't believe the characters and the dialogue, we don't believe the story. And so... Somebody
Agreed.
That could pull you into a fantasy, I think, is even a better actor
in a
than
lot
someone
of the
in
cases,
a drama.
Yeah, because in a lot of the cases, their set pieces aren't actually there. And so you have you have to imagine that something that isn't actually there is there. And you have to be a great actor to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, it's too bad. When we talk about taking the movie seriously, it's interesting because the storyline and the way the public takes them seriously is different than the way the Academy sees them, because the Academy... I think views these types of movies as the, like we were talking about, the popcorn movies that they just don't see as real art or whatever. I don't know what it is, but they're the standard action movies of our day, whether it's wrapped in a science fiction wrapper or wrapped in a comic book wrapper, whatever. They're just viewed as the sort of throwaway action film that you just do to make money, and that's not the
which is why
thing.
When Spielberg finally came out with The Color Purple to show that he could make something other than science fiction, they had to blacklist him and not you know, got nominated for 11 Academy Awards, but he wasn't nominated as Best Director, because how dare you show that you could do something? I mean, if you do science fiction, you can't do artsy stuff right. Like we do. It's quite a hypocrisy. Well, we are here with film critic Mark Boubian, and we are talking about some of the summer blockbusters coming, some of the earlier summer blockbusters that already came out in winter and spring. We'll be right back.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated, about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Do your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org. If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
You probably recognize that as a hybrid of music from the original Star Trek. Of course, Star Trek The Next Generation. But actually, the theme for Star Trek The Next Generation was first written for Star Trek The Motion Picture, which has got to be one of the most original titles for a movie I've ever heard. And then years later, when they wanted to jumpstart the series, they called the first one Star Trek. So future generations are going to go, no, there's a movie called Star Trek, and there's a movie called Star Trek The Motion Picture. Someone's going to have to go, well, they're both motion pictures, but they're different movies. And anyway, but Star Trek, the new Star Trek Into Darkness is one of the movies we are reviewing today with film critic Mark Boubian.
That's right. So, you know, what I was getting to with the list of movies is basically a lot of what we were talking about, how kind of we've changed culturally on what we view as a good or serious movie. Without giving all the movies in the list, I just covered a couple, but there are 8 science fiction movies this summer, and there are 4 comic book movies, and that's not even overlapping the two. So there are 4 separate comic book movies and 8 science fiction movies. When I was a kid, I couldn't see a science fiction movie to save my life. There was nothing like that. And a comic book movie, no way. So I am really excited about the way things have changed, because I love science fiction. And to me, comic book movies, the comic book movies they choose to cover have a very strong science fiction element to them anyway. So I think the movies to me are very appealing, even though I'm not a big comic book fan. Plus, there's a lot of original science fiction. You know, obviously, we've got Star Trek, which is not exactly original because it's based on a series. But to start with Oblivion, that was really the start of the summer, I think, for me. And that's the first big science fiction movie of the summer. It didn't do as well as they had hoped.
Oh, they didn't? I didn't realize that.
No, it didn't. Unfortunately,
you know why?
Well, Tom Cruise is just not the draw that he used to be. And I don't think they really advertised it. They were just depending on the star power of Tom Cruise. And Tom Cruise does pick some very unusual movies sometimes.
He was very good in the movie, though.
Absolutely.
I've never been a huge Tom Cruise fan, but when he's good, he's really good.
He is good. And I think that he's a great actor. I love almost every movie he's been in, and whether it's science fiction or not. But, you know, like Minority Reports, that was a Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah,
but so he had a lot more going for him then. But that was an unusual movie at the time. So he's just been a very... risk-taking actor.
And this movie was so creative. It was we won't give away the ending. We won't do a spoiler, but we will have to at least say that there's a twist, a good twist, and which goes such a long way with me, because while I was watching it, it was an okay movie. It was complex. Some of it you're trying to figure out what's going on. But when it was over, I said, this is a great movie, and that was because of the way they ended it.
Yeah, see, now for me, I love science fiction so much. I love to see science fiction elements like spaceships and planes and stuff like that. So while I was trying to figure out what's going on with the movie, I was enjoying greatly
what was
happening
on
screen.
It was very impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought it was very well done in that regard. So, and it's not really very much of a spoiler to say that there's some kind of twist, because you are trying to figure out what's going on from the very beginning. So what is going on is the question.
Good story should have a twist anyway. It's not a credit to our movies today when we say that a movie with a twist is an anomaly. You know, a good movie should have a twist ending, or it's not that good.
Right, that's a good observation. But what I think that says about the movie is that the movie is challenging our view of what is true and what is false. It's a movie about finding out truth and how important that is. And that's, I think, one of the interesting things that we were talking about moral relativism already. That's actually trying to get at what's true about morality or the way human beings act. What's true is important. It's imperative. And in this movie, that's kind of the conflict. What is going on? What's true? What's really happening here? And the characters are, some of the characters are willing to live not knowing the truth. Some don't care. Some want to know and maybe don't find out. But so the struggle with our primary character is not just finding out the truth, but how he responds to the truth that he discovers. And the human response is varied. You could go into denial. You can accept it. You can... you know, embrace it and challenge it or whatever. But I think that is something that very imperative about our humanity. And again, I think that this is another thing that points to God, where Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but me. Why does he say the truth there? Why is that thrown out? Because you don't, I mean, it's almost like a non sequitur.
Because he knows he's talking to a species, humankind, that looks for truth.
Right, exactly.
Or should be looking for truth.
And that he's claiming to be the ultimate truth. The truth doesn't happen without him. And philosophically, that's one of the things that I really latch onto in terms of Christianity, that without God, really, truth doesn't exist. It doesn't even matter that whatever is happening in the world or happening to us as a species, it loses all meaning. Truth, who cares what things are? So without God, there really is no truth, and there's no consequences to whether the truth exists or not. So it stops mattering. So just this is stuff I think about all the time.
Well, and in the Gospels, when Jesus went before Pilate, and we know that historically Pilate was a real cutthroat. He was a pretty evil man, and yet even he was taken with Jesus, and when Jesus called himself the truth, he said, what is truth?
Right.
For that moment, this Roman tyrant is talking like a philosopher. Even he says, this is a nutty world. What is truth? He almost says it with a desperation, like, I'm desperate to know what that is.
Right, because we become jaded in our lives. I think I've gone through that. I look at that. What is truth? Like, after 9/11... you know, you look at what is evil and how people responded to that. What's the truth of that event? How do we deal with that and stuff? And I think that is a very key question. And again, it's one of the defining elements of being human and our relationship to God. So a movie that is trying to delve into the truth, I think, is one that is reflecting God, whether or not they intend to or not. Now, I also felt in this movie that there was the Christ figure type of element going on.
Oh, the sacrifice. In the film. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so, and there's a thing about, I think, blood being imperative too in the movie. I'm not sure, actually. I may be mixing up movies, but anyway, there still is the Christ aspect to that. So having those mixed in, and again, that's one of the things I like about these movies, where if the atheist loves science fiction and is looking to fill a void, what are they filling it with? Well, the science fiction is pointing to God, ironically enough, for the atheist. So I think that that's something that's very telling.
A couple of weeks ago, after speaking at a church, two atheists who came because they heard we were going to be discussing Bible apologetics came up to my table afterwards, a man and a woman, young man, young woman. They said, we're atheists and we attend the Unitarian Church. Hmm. Now, I don't believe what Unitarians believe, but I had to ask them, why are you going to any church at all if you're atheist?
Right.
I'll never forget what the guy says just a couple of weeks ago. He says, because everybody needs God, even though God doesn't exist.
I actually had a similar conversation with a friend years ago in college where he wanted to raise his children in church, but he didn't believe in God. And it was exactly the same sort of answer, that he felt like God gave the kids a good foundation. But if it's a false foundation, what's the point? But then again, if God doesn't exist, who cares? It doesn't matter.
And when I was a little kid, my parents actually raised me as an atheist. So I was an atheist all the way up through my senior year in high school. But I wished that there was a God. Now, some would say, oh, well, so you wished that there was a God, so you imagined
God. Self-fulfilling thing,
yeah. It didn't happen that way. God, if God didn't exist, I can't wish him into existence. And if he does exist, you not believing him doesn't make him disappear. But it is true that there's a vacuum inside of all of us that says, wouldn't it be nice if there was something out there that, so that we know where right. we came from, where we're going, who created us, who we answer to. Who loves us, who cares about it. There's a lot of pluses to the idea of a God.
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, fortunately, I think that you and I, Bob, both have not come to this through wishful thinking or wanting that, but actually exploring intellectually as well as emotionally and experientially who God is.
Yeah, well, when we get tempted to sin, there's times when I go, gee, boy, if God didn't exist.
Right, I wish
things are. So it's not the.
It's a mixed
bag.
It's
not just the crutch people make it out to be. There's such a thing as you have to take a stand when you're following God, too.
Right, and it's not always easy. So I was going to say, this is a great segue into Star Trek, but I don't see the segue, so let's just talk about Star Trek anyway.
Okay.
J.J. Abrams. Now, we could use this as a segue. I was going to say about J.J. Abrams, what's interesting is he did Lost, and Lost had a lot of this.
Which I still think is the best thing that's ever been on television, Lost.
And I liked it very much. So Lost was sort of this Christian mythology, very strongly rooted in Christian ideas and visions and things like that.
And yet Abrams is an atheist, isn't he?
I think he's self-professed.
I don't mean to put words in his mouth. I believe he said that.
And I don't know. I know Joss Whedon, and I confuse these two guys because, you know, Joss Whedon's
the guy
Avengers,
that did Buffy. And yeah.
Yeah. So, but Joss Whedon is an avowed atheist. I don't know about J.J. Abrams, but Star Trek is kind of viewed, you know, we got hassled about talking about Star Trek because Star Trek is sort of viewed as the atheist tentpole for science fiction. You know, it's really anti-God.
And yet there's a lot of religion in a lot of Star Trek episodes.
Yes,
honestly.
There is, ironically. And the Next Generation almost tried to deny God from the human standpoint, but then they go on and embrace the notion of a God existing in the other alien culture, so they tried to have it both ways. But, you know, it's become sort of culturally a sort of atheistic thing. So I think it's very interesting that J.J. Abrams would take on Star Trek as this quote-unquote atheist type of
Well, it is premised
movie.
On the theory of evolution. That's true.
Right.
But there are theistic evolutionists, so I don't think that that immediately disqualifies God.
Right. It doesn't. But I still find it a very interesting thing, given what he did with Lost, that he'd take this on as well. So, and I think he's done a very wonderful job with the new movies. I have my criticisms. I don't like the new Kirk at all. I find him to be too one-dimensional and sort of, you know, I'm anti-Prime Directive, you know.
Well, I know William Shatner was more swashbuckling than Patrick Stewart, but they've made this guy so swashbuckling, it's almost hard to imagine him as Kirk.
Right, exactly. He's not, I don't imagine as Kirk at all.
And whereas the other characters all fit their role. Spock seems like Spock. McCoy, of course, is just, he seems like an actor doing a DeForest Kelly impersonation when he talks.
Right, he's very good at that, and I love him for that. And I don't think he was utilized enough in this new movie, but in the last movie, he was very good. But the movie really focused a lot on Kirk. And so I think it really came out that Kirk is a little too over the top. You know, I don't see him as somebody that can pull off any of the emotional elements that William Shatner was really able to pull off, even though Shatner's been criticized as a bad actor. Seeing,
you know, his acting really wasn't that bad.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was bad at all. I think he was a great actor.
Particularly, and I do think in the original series, he underplayed it more. He was a little over the top in the movies. In the original series, his acting was just first rate, I thought.
I agree, totally. And I've seen him in other things where he's very funny as well. And you can see that
they finally gave him the Emmy Award for Boston Legal. I'm glad the guy finally got that. Okay. And he was fantastic in Boston Legal.
That's great.
I'm glad he finally got some accolades like that. He deserves it.
My favorite William Shatner is a TV commercial. ThePrice.com.
He's very good.
There's a surfing one where he's I live for the big waves, man. He's standing on the shore. He's 80-year-old man with a surfboard under his arm. I live for the waves, and it's an awesome commercial. But you know, that's William Shatner. He's able to make fun of himself after all these years, and I liked the second
Star Trek more than the first one. In the first one, I loved the first half. I thought while they were at the Academy, I loved the character development. I hated what you loved, if I'm remembering our reviews. I hated the fact that they changed the timeline. I didn't like seeing change the timeline. I didn't like seeing Vulcan destroyed. However, objectively, I thought it was an act of brilliance on the part of J.J. Abrams to do that, because I don't know this, but I was assuming he was saying, look, if we're going to jumpstart Star Trek, we don't want to have to deal with Star Trek geeks that have these 35-some years of folklore always correcting us that this can't happen because of this episode. That. So now we have a perfect excuse. We've changed the timeline. Two problems. One, they said they changed the timeline, but there's a place where Spock explains to the young Kirk what happened in the correct timeline, and he says, yes, your parents were proud the day you graduated the Academy. Well, now I'm going to sound like a Star Trek geek, but in the first season, there's an episode called about Kodos the Executioner, where it's very clear that Kirk was a little kid and watched his parents executed by Kodos the Executioner. So for all their effort to wipe out the timeline, they didn't get the timeline right anyway. But then the second thing is this, Mark, and this takes me to the second movie. The second movie, they still made the distortion of the timeline a big part of the movie. And so that makes me wonder now, what were they trying to... I thought they were going to do that once, and then they were going to just kind of hope in a way we'd forget about that so that they could move on and do different kinds of stories. But boy, if you didn't understand the other timeline, you could be lost in this movie. Now, I went to see it with my girlfriend Dana, and she did enjoy it, but there were things in there that she didn't actually understand. And when I tried to explain a little bit about some of the other movies, she looked at me like I had lobsters crawling out of my ears. So, but I'm wondering, why are they still sticking so much to the other timeline if they were trying to get away from that? Or am I misunderstanding what their intentions were from the beginning?
Well, Bob. How much time do we have left to explain that? first off, just to challenge your geek side, Star Trek has never been consistent with its own stupid timeline in the first place.
No, but they were at least trying for some consistency by changing the timeline. So how hard could it have been for them to research an old episode? I don't know.
But old episode? I'm sure there's another episode in there somewhere that says Kirk's parents were alive later.
Oh, maybe.
I mean, they contradicted themselves.
They do.
Left
well, they
right.
do. That's true.
So
That's
it's not true. Like Star Wars or The Lord of the Rings or, you know, other things that have really depended on consistency.
Yeah, George Lucas never contradicts himself. He just goes back and rewrites the movie
right,
and pretends that's the way it always was.
Well, that's a little different. Yeah, but he is actually consistent within the storylines. But to expect them to be consistent, that I don't know if that's fair. However, Ironically, what you pointed out about me liking about the movie, you had it half right. What I liked about the movie is that I thought it was consistent, but with the Next Generation storyline.
Yes, where they left Spock on Romulus at the end of the Next Generation.
Correct. And so that there was a whole, they built the story
out of
that.
There was continuity with that, yes.
Yeah, and there's even a comic book that precedes the movie that the writers wrote, because they couldn't fit it all in the movie, so they released it as a sort of comic book prequel, and that story has Data and Captain Picard in it, and you see what's happened to them, and so it's very, very strongly rooted in the previous timeline. It's just that, you know, they're just not going to get everything dead on right. Now, I actually think that the new movie refers to things in the old timeline, so to speak, or another way to look at it is to say that this movie refers to some of the other movies or the earlier series, and you see elements. You see a character like there's a woman that in a previous movie married or didn't marry Kirk but had his child.
Right.
She appears as a character in this movie. So it's exciting to see her because you know that, but that's not what plays out in the movie, this movie, even though it plays out in another movie. So there's sort of references, but they have broken free of that previous timeline. So I don't think it's actually necessary that it was that you were aware of the fact that there was this other set of Star Trek movies.
I guess
or
on one level you wouldn't have had to know any of that,
right?
I guess, but
I think it made it for me. Now I went into the movie totally cold. I saw no preview or no.
So you were pleasantly surprised.
Absolutely,
by that stuff.
Yeah, and I loved everything because for me, I'm a Star Trek fan, so I like seeing the references, and to me, it really enhanced the experience of the movie. So I think it's an additional quality of the film for fans to see those things, but to not have to say, oh, they got this exactly right, or that's
but
exactly
they, are
right.
I'm almost wondering, whereas I thought they were going to try to deviate from Star Trek by changing the storyline, this time I'm going, it almost looks like every episode they're going to want to come back now and have an alternate version of it.
Yeah.
We see Kirk do, again, we're trying to avoid the spoilers, we see Kirk do something that Spock did in a previous movie.
Correct.
And I'm watching this going, is the next one going to be called Star Trek III, The Search for Kirk? I mean, you know, it's just,
yeah,
it gets crazy after a while.
I actually was going to use that because I knew you were going to ask that question. I had that line already,
oh,
Bob, but you
gosh.
Stole it from
did
me.
Did I steal your thunder? Sorry, Mark.
That's okay. But I did read after seeing the movie, because I wasn't going to read anything before, that basically J.J. Abrams said they wanted to change this timeline, not because they were worried about the geeks attacking them, but they wanted the opportunity to start and do their own thing without having to really worry about being 100% accurate. I mean, they are doing a good job of paying an homage to the characters, whether, you know, even though they don't get it exactly right in my mind and in your mind, but I feel like they're doing a good job of referencing things and connecting to Star Trek while breaking new ground and doing new and interesting things. So they're not locked into doing Star Trek 1, Star Trek 2, Star Trek 3, Star Trek 4 all over again. They're able to change it or to have new ground. Now, before, when we saw the first movie, I think one of the questions people asked is, are they going to do Star Trek 2 just like they did in the original movies? And the irony is that people ask that question without thinking that the first Star Trek of J.J. Abrams' universe was nothing like the Star Trek movie, Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Star Trek the Motionless Picture, where
right.
Nomad has gone before, as the Trekkies like to call it.
Yes, exactly. So that the new Star Trek, it was nothing like that movie, yet they expected Star Trek 2 to be like Star Trek 2, the second movie of J.J. Abrams. So there was sort of an ironic thing there. But to get out of that irony and to say, I don't think that they're going to try to retread every movie. They probably will. You know, we may see a whale movie at some point in the future, but to have fun with it rather than to to try and redo it, or I don't think they don't want to feel obligated to be doing it, but they want to feel free.
Or maybe in the alternate dimension, Kirk will save the dolphins instead of the whales, so it'll be completely different.
Right, there you go.
Hey, I like Star Trek 4.
Oh, yeah, I love Star Trek 4. It was one of their better ones. Although I have to say, I've always felt with all the different incarnations, to me, Star Trek works better as a series. And one of my other criticisms of the movies is, I mean, the action is first rate, the special effects are first rate, but characters is what Star Trek was about. And although they have done a good job of staying consistent with the characters, in the episodic series, you don't see the action as much nonstop, and they leave more room for dialogue and story development, which I appreciate. I think when they're making a movie only every 4 years or so, there's just all these elements they think they have to pack into it. And I, given my druthers, I'd rather see Star Trek return as a television series than as a movie every 4 years.
Okay, so I have about five answers to that, but let me...
Each one in a different space-time continuum.
For me, I like the movies of Star Trek. Now, the original movies with the original cast, however, it really depended on the series having existed prior to the films.
That's right.
You needed to know the characters going into the movies, and I think that... That really played to the movie's advantage, though, because you would already develop the characters, and then you saw them do the things that they would do as those characters from 10 years prior on TV. So you didn't have to develop them. They were already developed, and they took advantage
of that.
That's true. However, I think that played against the Next Generation. They canceled the show. Then they went right to movies. You had it in your mind that this was just a series. They did basically one good movie, and the rest of the movies were not very good. And it would have survived better as a TV show. However, even with that said, this is the third observation I would make. The last couple of series in Star Trek just lost all their momentum and started to suck completely. They stunk.
Well, not Deep Space Nine. I thought Deep Space Nine was the best of all.
Absolutely.
Of them,
they reached their peak and then they crashed and burned.
Well, Voyager ruined Star Trek for me, and unfortunately I never tried Enterprise, and that's because of Voyager.
And Enterprise was only a teeny, teeny, tiny bit better than Voyager. I watched it, and I kept saying it's going to get better. Then I realized I said that for 4 years of Voyager, and it never got better, so I gave up. And I even heard that Enterprise got better, watched one of the better episodes, and thought it stunk just as bad as the early episodes. So they really just crashed and burned, like I said. So on TV, the reason we don't want to see Star Trek return to TV, or we didn't when J.J. Abrams took over in 2009, we didn't want to see it back on TV because they weren't doing it right on TV. Now, J.J. Abrams has breathed some real new life into
the show. Well, he knows how to do good TV with things like Lost and things like Fringe. So
he probably could have breathed life into it, but I think that it just wasn't happening at the time, and Paramount wasn't willing to.
Plus, as William Shatner would tell him at the Star Trek convention, he wants to get a life and not only do Star Trek.
Right. That's probably true. He's going to do Star Wars, too. That's the life he's got.
Oh, my God, that's right. Star Wars is owned by Disney now.
And J.J. Abrams has been hired as director of the next Star
Wars
movie.
That's the first good news I've heard since I heard Disney bought it.
Yeah, now I've got a Star Wars friend. We both have a Star Wars friend that you know well.
Are we allowed to say his name over the air?
I think we can say
his
name is Richard.
Our friend Richard, I assume you're talking about? Richard, the famous Star Wars apologist?
Yes. Now, I said after seeing this most recent Star Trek movie, which is an absolute train ride of special effects and action, it's totally awesome. I loved it completely. That I said after the movie, this I do not have any concern about Star Wars now because of the ability to make such a special effects extravaganza. It looked good, be exciting, be fun and interesting. He actually had the exact opposite interpretation. One of his views, and this was him looking at it morally, not necessarily in terms of action, but he said that he felt the movie was a little too brutal. And I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but there are a couple of scenes where, now the movie begins with an act of terrorism, and Kirk goes chasing after the terrorist, and they catch him. He surrenders actually to Kirk, and Kirk is angry because the guy killed one of Kirk's friends, Christopher Pike, the captain that recruits Kirk.
Who now isn't around for the best Star Trek episode ever made, The Menagerie.
Yeah, right.
Thanks to the timeline being changed.
Good. Which, we may be thankful for our lucky stars. But Anyway, there's a lot of punching and hitting to a point where it does come across as brutal. And it now I
and
felt
yet
like
the message of the movie seems to be to be willing to not be so brutal to get your objectives.
Yeah, and so there's a speech at the end that kind of says that, and it's
but Richard
really
felt that there was too much violence along the road to their nonviolent message.
Not just violence, but this brutality where people are just getting pounded to smithereens, and you're seeing it unrelenting on screen. And now, for me, there was a reason for that to happen. Kirk had to beat him up because that's the way Kirk is. It fit the character. And there's another scene where the guy's beat up really badly also by Spock. But Spock is a Superman in a way, and the fight goes on for a long time for that reason. So there's reasons for it, but it still is a very brutal moment in the film.
I think, not just in movies, but in life, to me, violence itself is morally neutral. And why the violence is being waged, if an evil person's being stopped, I don't have a problem with that. It's like people go to the Bible, they go, well, the Bible says thou shalt not kill. I said, yeah, it does. And then a few verses later it says, and if you kill, we're going to kill you.
Right.
It's a different kind of kill. And so it depends. If it's fighting evil, to me it's a little bit different.
Right. But then there's fighting evil and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting evil on screen.
Right.
I think,
and then we get into that nonstop action. Well, we are out of time. Mark, we'll have you on again soon as some of these summer movies come out. We'll see you next week, everybody.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.